I'm very happy now to welcome Joseph Schuldiner. He is author of the new cookbook, Pure Vegan, 70 Recipes for Beautiful Meals and Clean Living. And Deborah Madison, she is author of many cookbooks, including the new one, The New Vegetarian Cooking for Everyone. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
Yeah, thank you.
So, Pure Vegan is such an interesting book because you, at first I was going to say, what are you doing a vegan cookbook for? Is it ideological? And right away, in the introduction to the book, you make it very clear that this is not a book about politics or about the earth or about how people should live, but it's basically the virtues of veganism and the really good food that can be cooked under these limitations. How did you come, Joseph, to actually write it?
Well, I consider myself vegan adjacent. So, the bulk of the food that I'm interested in is really plant-based, and I love that. But I felt like everyone was so dogmatic about the vegan lifestyle and whether you're a vegan or not. And I just love vegan dishes. And I decided to sort of liberate that from people's notion of the strictness of veganism and the militant aspect of eating a vegan diet, and inject a little bit of humor, and also to not, I'm not political in that sense, so I respect people who are political about their diets. But I felt like I wanted, like I said, to liberate that and just let people enjoy the food they're eating.
And it's interesting because I think of veganism, I'm very much of an omnivore myself, and I think of it as so limiting and so bland. I went once to a vegan restaurant in New York City, which was supposed to be the greatest restaurant of all time, and I almost perished from blandness. It was horrible. You do is something really different. You give people so many choices for having just really delicious food. I mean, I just read the book, but I haven't tried them out yet. But boy, it sounds like they're really, really fun to eat recipes.
Well, thank you. That's a great compliment. And, it's also why I wanted to photograph the book really lushly, is to, really inspire people about how beautiful it can be. But, I always, whenever I, met vegan people, it was always about what you couldn't eat, And I thought, it's about time someone inspired people like all the things you could eat. And I have to plug my partner in crime, Deborah Madison, for really, like, when, I'm one of the many thousands of people that discovered her Greens cookbook, and she did the same thing for vegetarian cooking, that it could be flavorful and delicious as much as anything else. And I felt like I wanted to do the same thing for vegan cooking. So
now, one of the things that's interesting is that rather than being organized by types of food, you have it organized by times of day, where you state very clearly that you eat constantly from dawn until late into the night.
Well, that's the bratty side of me. Is that I felt like I needed to shatter that image of who a vegan was. And again, you could be vegan all day long. And I thought it was a little salacious the way I did that. It starts off in the morning with breakfast, and then, lunch, dinner, very obvious. Then,
if I may say, it starts off in the morning with breakfast and Bloody Marys.
Yes, thank you. Vegan, vodka is vegan. So, there you go. I thought, late into the night, it's like, come on, you want to go out into the world. And if you notice, the late night and the very late night chapter is all alcohol and sweets. So, right. Come on.
I know. And I was thinking, when you talk about the health, people will make an argument for the health aspects of veganism. And it's like, well, you might not get heart disease, but you can still get diabetes and cirrhosis of the liver.
Right, but see, someone out there, you know, dictated that veganism was only about health or only about, you know, animal rights. And I think it's like any kind of diet, it's about so many things. I mean, you can't list them on your fingers how many things. So this is what I chose, and I never said it was going to be particularly, you know, healthy in any, you know, any specific way or anything more than anything else. And, you know, people should choose however they want to choose. But, you know, again, I think that we live in this world and here are some choices.
Now, the title of the book is Pure Vegan. Talk about purity. What do you mean by that?
Well, in the book, hopefully early on, I say I didn't call it puritanical vegan.
Right.
So we called it pure vegan because I think it's mainly that everything was vegan, is vegan in the book. And, you know, we're not making claims of anything else. So not much more behind that.
But, Joseph, didn't you have another title that you wanted to use?
Well, yes, I did. Should I?
Yeah.
You know, this is my first cookbook, and when I was pitching to publishers, and this is a while ago, and I was going to call it Vaguely Vegan, and I thought that everyone I knew was on the road to cleaning up their diet, and they were on their road to, you know, trying to eat a more plant-based diet, but always had trouble with it. And they felt like it was all or nothing, you know, like if you cheat once, you're out of the club or whatever. And I thought this would be such a great way to not shame people into a vegan diet. And, you know, maybe there's a little sort of animal products that creep in and out, and here you could substitute or not. But I think I was ahead of my time. I think now it would have been very embraced. But back then, I think people were a little nervous about being sort of vegan, you know, vaguely vegan or vegan adjacent. And look at Mark Bittman, vegan during the week and, you know, vegan Mondays, meatless Mondays, and, you know, all that has happened since I first pitched this book. So that was originally the intent.
Now, there's a lot in both of your books about ingredients. And I think it's really interesting and important to talk about ingredients, partly in terms of what makes for really good and delicious food, and also how much things have changed in the past, let's say, 20 years. I mean, since you first started writing Deborah Madison, the vegetarian cooking book, people are eating different things. I mean, food culture has changed.
Oh, it has enormously, which is why I wanted to redo this book, because it was still out in the world and selling well, but meanwhile, everything has changed. You know, how we're eating is different. We have so many different foods available to us that we didn't when I wrote this book, you know, in the 90s.
What are some examples of that?
Oh, there's lots of them. First of all, just to start at the beginning, we have farmers markets. You know, and they're really plentiful. And in the farmers markets are always increasingly new varieties and interesting varieties of vegetables that we may not have known. Different kinds of tomatoes is a good example, or kinds of potatoes, eggplants, just varieties. You know, it's exciting. It's not just one, you know, one of everything. Lots of spices, sashimi togarashi, which nobody used to use, this Japanese mixture of seven spices, is delicious. We have lots of smoked things, smoked paprika, smoked salt, lots of flavored salts. When I wrote this book, if I wanted to get smoke in there, I had to use it via chipotle chilies. So everything was hot if it was smoky. Now we can just have smoky flavors. There's all these plant milk beverages that we didn't used to have, the coconut beverage, almond, hemp, rice. You know, it was soy and only soy, and you could barely find that when I first started writing. And now it's everywhere, lots of plant milks.
And soy has gone slightly out of favor, at least in some circles, because there's so much genetically modified soy.
Oh, yeah. And we've changed our feeling about soy. I mean, when I first wrote Vegetarian Cooking for Everyone, it was So there was sort of the feeling that tofu was going to save us. You know, if you ate tofu and you ate a lot more tofu, then you were, you know, you were home free. Now we're not so sure about tofu. We know that fermented forms of soy are better us.
What do you mean,
miso and tempeh, natto, which will probably never be very popular here. It's really kind of weird, but miso and tempeh are much easier to deal with, and also some soy sauces. We have so many different grains available. If we look around, like millet grits, that's just new in the last few years. I can't find a store to carry them here in Santa Fe, but you can get them, Bob's Red Mill. They cook beautifully. They're a very strongly anti-inflammatory grain, so it's one we might want to consider. And they're much easier to work with than whole millet. We have coconut oil. We didn't have coconut oil. We didn't used to.
And it's also very interesting, and both of you have talked about this, I think, too, that, I mean, there used to be, probably around the time that I was a kid, lots of very serious medical magazines extolling the virtues of margarine.
Sure.
And now it's really considered bad, whereas coconut oil and butter, which have saturated fats, actually turn out to be, compared to this synthetic stuff, pretty good for you.
Yeah, there's... I know. I feel it's so hard for all of us actually to keep up with and make sense of this kind of information. But maybe because I grew up on a dairy farm and we had our own butter from Jersey and Guernsey cows, I've had a strong prejudice towards real food, particularly butter. But margarine was, you know, I grew up in the era when you squeeze the color into it. And it was pretty disgusting until you got it, turned it yellow, and I hear
and
you.
And it's disgusting. If you taste it, it's just foul.
I mean, even the new, not hydrogenated margarine.
You can taste that
so
stuff
good.
A mile away.
And Joseph, I think you use that, but I try. You know, I have bought it so many times, and it sits around, and then I throw it away.
Yeah.
I can't, I just don't like using it.
I've also come around, too. You know, I want to add to that the whole... I think when people first started thinking about being vegetarian was always about what is meat like, substituting something for meat, and all the advent of these really overprocessed commercial meat products, you know, vegetarian meat products. And I think that what's so important is that why, if you're going to eat chicken, if you want chicken, you know, either eat it or don't eat it, but don't eat fake chicken. And there's so, you know, there's so many interesting things in the vegetable world on its own that taste good, that you don't want to, like, you know, have fake meat. So I've really gone over to, like, not even wanting something to taste like meat, you know, or dairy. Yeah.
Yeah, but I hear you very clearly with that, and I feel the same way. And actually, I feel like I need to be responsible to my readers. I need to have some experience with things like non-dairy cheese. And so, again, I go out and buy it. I try it once, and then it turns moldy. And I just can't seem to go there.
It is. I used to call that carob syndrome. It's like, if you want to eat chocolate, eat chocolate.
Oh, yeah, there's another one. Now chocolate's okay.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
You know,
right.
No one talks about carob anymore. I haven't heard that in years. I think a lot of these are fads, too, that they come and, you know, they come and go, and scientists, just, you know, they discover something and then everything changes and then it changes again.
But I think the point that the two of you are making is a strong one, which is rather than using substitutes, use the delicious things in their full glory. And so if you're going to eat nuts. If you want to eat chicken, but don't try to make something be something else.
Yeah, that would be my impulse.
Right, right. And all those spices and flavorings that Deborah just, you know, listed, it's like those are all so delicious on their own, and they're not masquerading as something else, you know?
Now, one of the things that you do, we're talking to Joseph Schuldiner about his new cookbook, Pure Vegan, and Deborah Madison about her new cookbook, The New Vegetarian Cooking for Everyone. One of the things that I thought was really interesting is, Joseph, you use tea leaves, no tea bags, ladies and gentlemen, but tea leaves, not only for drinking tea, but for cooking.
Tea is another one of those wonderful, wonderful flavoring agents. I'm just such a a diehard tea drinker. I love tea. And whole leaf tea has so much flavor in it. And Deborah, you were mentioning smoke. I so agree with you that the Lapsang Souchong Chinese smoked tea is like a delicious campfire. And I've been adding that to things to get that incredible smoky flavor. And tea is healthy too. So, along with the advent of the internet, you know, no matter where you live, you can find these ingredients and begin experimenting with them.
And a lot of them you could just find here. I mean, you know, they don't have to be brought from afar. We have accessibility. When I was sent Joseph's book to write a little blurb, I opened it up, and I thought, this is a beautiful book. I love the photographs. And then I thought, this guy's not vegan. This is too much fun. You know, so I think I called you, or I wrote to you, and I said, are you really vegan? And I don't remember what you said, but I love the spirit of your book. And I actually... You're busy shattering the vegan image of being bland or very, very strict. And I've had to do the same thing in the more wider diet of, you know, vegetarian food. I just think of it as the plant side of the plate. It doesn't have to be about making a lifestyle choice or decision about this or that. You know, we should all be eating plant foods. They're delicious. They're what we're told to eat. It's probably what's going to be around more than animal foods, I suspect. So I feel like I've had to cover some of the same territory as you have. It's just about food that's delicious. And some of our recipes actually overlap, which is funny because...
Really?
Yeah, they do. Like, I think you have a Romesco sauce, and I do too. And in fact, in the new vegetarian cooking for everyone, one of the things I did, and I always had wanted to do it, was to label the recipes that happened to be vegan.
I know, I saw that, yeah.
Yeah, and I don't, and it's not that I want to, that I'm creating a vegan book. They were always there. I just labeled them so people can find them. And, you know, because sometimes people need to, for whatever reason, it might as well make it easier for them.
Well, and it's like in restaurants now, a lot of people have GF for gluten-free mm-hmm. on their menus, which is really helpful because not that many people have celiac disease, but a lot of people, for whatever reason, have become sensitive to wheat, which may be due to GMO. We don't even really know why that's happening.
Yes, it seems to have to do with newer varieties of wheat and how it's growing, because I've interviewed lots of people who don't seem to have a reaction to older wheats that were being grown before the 60s, before the Green Revolution. And in fact, in Los Angeles, where Joseph is, at the Santa Monica Farmers Market, there is Kettner Farms that's selling fabulous old strains of wheat, Sonoran White, Red 5. I've bought Turkey Red in Minneapolis. There are people all around the country who apparently don't have a problem when they eat the old varieties, and
very
so they're having them grown and milled again.
The grain movement, I think, is really the next frontier. We are really like discovering all these ancient grains, and more farmers are planting them. And as Deborah mentioned, Los Angeles, we just got our first new independent grain mill in over 80 years, and she is only grinding. Only milling heirloom grain, and that's unprecedented. And I think it's really exciting to be testing these new grains and tasting these new grains. It really is a new frontier.
Yeah, and in terms of grains and old varieties, that was another thing that I added to vegetarian, the new vegetarian cooking for everyone, because even though it's very ancient, we didn't start becoming familiar with einkorn or emmer, with farro, with spelt, with kamut, with a lot of these grains until fairly recently.
It's like, for me and probably for a lot of our listeners, you've started talking a new language.
Not really.
I don't know. I don't know half of the things that you just said.
Well, you know what?
That's why we wrote these books, right?
Right. Because now when you go to the market, you'll see, Jovial is a company in Italy that makes einkorn pasta. you know. So Einkorn is a very ancient grain.
It sounds German.
The name is German. And anyway, I talk about it in the book, and maybe you do in your book. I don't know, Joseph, but more and more people are talking about these, that they are apparently so much easier to assimilate, and now they're more available.
Right.
I think it's a really important point that you guys are making, and that you are living in the way you cook and in these cookbooks that you write, that, I mean, you've both used the word new frontier, and, I mean, we're talking about organic food, which is much more available than it used to be. We're talking about urban farming and farmers markets and ways of living that are really kind of models for sustainable non-corporate eating, essentially.
Oh, well, I'm very big on non-corporate eating. I think we absolutely have to eat in a non-corporate way if we're going to save our lives. I mean, it's, if you see Fed Up, the movie, it just came out this week. It tells you a great deal about that. But even without the movie, I've always felt that you have to go back to food in its most primitive form, you know, without things having been done to it, if you want to have any control over your health.
Your health and the health of the ecosystems all around us is the other part of it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think that I'm noticing so many people who really don't know where their food comes from, and they, you know, farmers markets have been such an incredible sea change in people being able to talk directly to farmers and know, like, what is in season and what isn't, because they didn't know. But at the institute that I run, the Institute of Domestic Technology here in Los Angeles, we're teaching basic food preservation skills, like how to make jam, how to make pickles. And people have no idea. They have no idea how the food they buy in a supermarket is made until they make it themselves. And I think that's made people more curious, and they want to know growing practices, which they would never have thought about, you know, years ago. So I think that's really important.
A friend of mine lives in Bangor, Maine, and is a member of the Bangor Bacon Club. And they started out thinking, well, how do you make bacon anyway? And now for years they've been curing their own meats and have a really sophisticated meat curing little subculture out in Maine.
Yeah. And I mean, I know we're talking about vegan vegetarian cookbooks, but I mean, you have to be walking around with your eyes closed if you travel at all and you don't notice how much meat preservation, especially this in the realm of salumi and raising meat, and young people who are butchers and beginning to work with the whole animal. And actually, I'm very much for this. It's definitely a sea change. Although it's in a city like Portland, Oregon, it's a little overwhelming. I mean, if you want bacon margaritas, they have them. You know, it's every place you turn.
Deborah, And this is why, you know, I think that Tom at The Real Butcher Shop, you know, he is doing this. And I think that, you know, even though it's the opposite of what we're doing, it's with meat, but it in essence still the same thing. And I think that's why, you know, we picked that. I think it shows that no matter what you're doing, as long as you are conscientious and sourcing really well, you're making an impact. So I think it's a great sort of crashing in of two worlds doing the same thing, and that's what we're going to do on Sunday.
Yeah, I didn't announce that at the beginning. The two of you will be presenting your books on Sunday, the 25th of May, at The Real Butcher Shop in Casa Solana here in Santa Fe from 5 to 8 in the afternoon. And I just think it's hilarious that a vegan and a vegetarian cookbook are going to be presented at a butcher shop.
Well, yes, I think both Joseph and I, and also Tom Delahante, whose store it is, are very interested in mixing things up, because it really is about the process of the food. And Tom himself does plan to have produce, to have vegetarian and vegan stocks, as well as whole animals and young butchers on board, and bakers and cheesemakers and so forth and so on. So I think it's really about the integrity of food, not so much the label of meat, vegetarian, vegan. So we're all for mixing it up and having a good time.
And Deborah, I don't know about you, but meat eaters have been such a huge fan base for my book. They come to me and say, you know, we're so used to eating meat, we don't know how to cook vegetables. and it's become a primer for them. And I have a feeling it's the same thing with you.
Yeah, I think it's really amazing how many people don't know where to begin with vegetables. And, you know, I kind of take it for granted since it's what I do, you know, all the time. But people do tell me that. And it's very humbling because I might not think to include a recipe, although I did include it, and I'm thinking of this a parsnip puree. But Brian Terry, who is one of your another wonderful vegan writer, he said about that, at the time I was eating dairy and I didn't know what parsnips were, and I got them in my CSA box, and there was your recipe for a parsnip puree with probably butter in it, you know, and it was so good, and it got him started on parsnips, you know. So yes,
right.
There's nothing too simple, really, not to include.
Well, I think the great insight for me in looking at these two books, and for me being, I mean, bacon is one of the four food groups for me, but I realized that I don't have to be a vegan to cook recipes out of a vegan cookbook. They're just one more choice of delicious foods that you can eat. And I have to say, I mean, as we've discussed, the photographs in this book, Pure Vegan, are absolutely exquisite. And some of the things are really tempting, especially I, you know, as many people do, love snacks. And there's things like the no cheese plate. What are some of the items on that?
So I'm a wine drinker, and I've grown to love really good farmstead cheeses, and I've always loved, and being an artist too, I love the cheese plate arrives with all the little accoutrements that come with the cheese. And I thought those should shine on their, you know, on their own. So I had this incredible, it's a fig pate, which is really dried figs ground up with fennel seeds and some balsamic vinegar, and made into a log and then cut into coins. And I have a baked, sort of dehydrated pear slices coated with a little coat of sugar on there. And then a membrillo, which is this heavenly sort of cross. It's originally Spanish, but it's quince paste, which is sort of it's like a jam that is so thick you can slice it with a knife. And those are the sort of traditional things you serve with, you know, cheese on the cheese plate. I just thought they're so beautiful and so tasty that they should shine on their own. And I'm a brat, so I titled it the no cheese plate.
Well, which is great because, again, we get a picture of it, and it really looks like one of those decadent and delicious late night sliceable plates of
actually, come to think of it, I often serve something like that for dessert.
Yeah.
You know, I almost, in the winter especially, I put out nuts for people to crack. I put out some chocolate. I love membrillo. I love anything with quince, dried fruits, figs, medjool dates. You know, just in a range of tastes and textures to eat around. I never thought of it as vegan, but I guess it is.
there you go. And also, you know, I grew up in a very progressive household. You know, my family were dancers and artists and very influenced by other cultures, especially growing up in Los Angeles. It was easy to do. And, you know, Middle Eastern cultures, Mediterranean cultures have so many vegan dishes and recipes that just happen to be vegan. They don't call themselves vegan. And that was really inspirational for me to turn to other cultures' recipes.
And that's, for a long time, I think, been the standby for vegetarian cooks, because the rest of the world, especially around the Mediterranean, is so rich in recipes that happen not to have the meat. They go with the meat, and they're delicious.
We're talking to Deborah Madison about the book, The New Vegetarian Cooking for Everyone, and to Joseph Schuldiner about his cookbook, Pure Vegan. And Joseph, you mentioned wine a moment ago, and Deborah has a whole section in her book about wine, which traditionally has been these wines go with those meats and poultry and fish. And for vegetarians, how do you make the pairing between the wine and the food?
Oh, I'm terrible at this, actually. It's it has a lot to do with acidity, with body, and what kinds of things you're serving. If you're using serving dishes that are rich in cream, say, or cheeses, often a Chardonnay, a French-style Chardonnay, is a really good match. Summer cooking, Mediterranean flavors, grilled vegetables is a good time for a Zinfandel, but it's just as good for a lovely Provençal rosé. I think we have a lot more freedom than was previously thought with wines. So you have to consider your own tastes and the kinds of wine you like. I like really earthy, earth-forward, not fruit-forward wines, and I think they go well with a great deal of vegetable dishes, a lot of them. Other people might like something more sweeter, more fruity, more alcoholic, you know, and they can negotiate their own way, but it's not such a issue, really.
Well, it sounds like there's just a kind of freedom rather than orthodoxy about who drinks what with what.
Well, and that's even changed in the world of meat and wine, too. I mean, it used to be, oh, Cabernet Sauvignon, you have that with a big steak, or your white wine with fish, and now we know that's not necessarily true.
I don't know. I mean, I'm not really so knowledgeable on the wine pairings. I kind of leave that to others. But in Pure Vegan, I really explored cocktails because I feel like cocktails are like recipes, and the cocktails in the book use a lot of fresh herbs and fresh produce in the cocktails. So I feel like, you know, cocktails can be so delicious. And why does it have to be separate from you know, vegan dishes? So I'm really been very interested in the sort of mixology movement that's happening and working with farmers and fresh ingredients and mixing that with spirits. And I think that's something that's really just delicious and beautiful and goes kind of an appetite, enhancer, I think. So in the book, I have a number of cocktail recipes that kind of deal with that issue.
I love your slogan, vodka is vegan. I think somebody should make a bumper sticker.
I actually was just I had a few more things to say about wine, too, but I did just see a bumper sticker in Oregon that said grateful for gluten, and it was from a bakery, so there you go. But I think that there are some obvious things to think about because so many vegetarian dishes are derived from other countries. It makes sense to drink the wines of those countries. If you're making food that's largely from Tuscany, if you're doing something with white beans and rosemary and good olive oil, well, have a Chianti, you know, have a Tuscan-style wine. There are also things to consider if you're drinking wine throughout your meal and you're having it with salad. You do have to think about the vinegar, the acidity, and the dressing, and maybe emphasize more if you have, say, a blue cheese in a salad, or you have roasted nuts, or you have an element that ties to the wine, and keep the vinegar down, you know, because you don't want to ruin a good wine by having something that just interferes, you know, with it altogether. And of course, some vegetables are very sugary and sweet. They naturally have a lot of sugars in them, like carrots do, winter squash, sweet potatoes. Others are less so, mushrooms, artichokes, and so forth. So they're going to call for different wines. They're going to let you go in slightly different directions. And that's good to know.
Deborah Madison, the original version of Vegetarian Cooking for Everyone came out in 1997, and you'd been working on it for years before that. What is different in the new version, and what was the process for you of taking that real magnum opus and making another magnum opus?
Well, it's not as awesome as it thinks, as you might guess, because for one, it's not a new book. It's a new version of a book, and so a lot of the material needed to stay. You want people to be able to find their favorite recipes and a style that they're used to. So a lot of the content is the same, although I did find myself taking out recipes that I thought were very dated or maybe just way over the top, too complicated, too rich. And I did add 150 to 200, somewhere in there, new recipes that tend to be very straightforward, more in the style of vegetable literacy.
What's an example of a dated recipe? What does that mean?
Well, you know, okay, here's what comes to mind, I guess. Eggplant parmigiana. You know, that was the only vegetarian dish you could get in the 70s. And it was always goppy and layered, and it was a casserole. Now it's more common to deconstruct that and make it lighter and not have it just, you know, stacked up and layered and heavy. So that would be an example. I think, too, when I wrote this book, a lot of the options for vegetarians, or the main option, was the stir fry, you know, with rice for dinner. I am not a stir fry person. I don't really enjoy making them, and I'm not good at it. And to do the book in the first place, I actually had to take lessons from somebody so I could at least get it somewhat right. But for this version, I took out some of the stir fries because I felt they were just too complicated, and also there's so many experts now in you know, in every cuisine of every country that can do them better. You know, I thought I'm just going to leave the core that you can turn to, and instead I replace them with what I call vegetable sautés, which is not the stir fry method in a wok, starting with ginger and, you know, scallions and garlic, and you have to go really fast to make a lot of noise. But it is a sautéed dish that may include, in addition to aromatics, two or three vegetables. Very straightforward, very simple. I just thought I would group those together and put them in the same chapter with the stir fries, but you'll have different expectations with them.
Very interesting. And what are some of the new types of recipes that you added? I mean, were they things that came in because of the new ingredients that are more readily available?
Sometimes there are some. There's a little timbao made with the millet grits that I mentioned earlier. There's a number of pastas made with einkorn pasta, einkorn spaghetti, or very dark, rich, wonderful, nutty-tasting spaghettis with the vegetables that are good, you know, with those, like overgrown arugula or handfuls of sage. And some of the recipes just are things I've learned since then. For example, there's a ginger chutney. I just made it last night, which I love. And it's just lots of ginger fried. It's thinly sliced. It's browned in a little ghee with chilies, with curry leaves. It's pounded to a paste. It's mixed with tamarind. So you have the hot ginger, the chili, the sour tamarind, a little sweet coconut sugar. It's just delicious. I mean, I could eat this for every single day. Try not to. There's a curry I just started making a couple of years ago I love, with roasted cauliflower. And that's cooked then in a very savory, spicy, rich, warm tomato sauce. And sometimes I add a little paneer to it or serve it with that ginger chutney. So there's a variety. I think that there's lots more desserts, too, because I happen to love desserts. But every chapter does have something in it that wasn't there before. But I have a funny story. There was one recipe I was going to take out. It's a risotto gratin because it's very delicious, but it's very rich, and it's just not an everyday dish. And I was talking about it in front of a group, and I said, I'm going to take this out, for example. I was talking about the changes in the book. And this woman raised her hand. She says, you can't take it out. And I said, why not? And she said, because my girlfriend and I make that for each other every birthday. Aww. That they share. And I was so touched by that. I did leave it in. And because it really said to me, there are occasions, you know, when you're going to be over the top, when it is too rich and it is all the starch you're maybe not going to eat every day, but it's just right for your birthday with your girlfriend. So,
well, that's a really good point, because I mean, a cookbook doesn't necessarily have to be everyday cooking.
No, and people like a challenge. I mean, if you're having a dinner party or you're, you know, hosting an event for somebody, you want to maybe make more of an effort. We're very focused on everyday cooking and the need to be fast and get it to the table in a hurry and all that. But there are also weekends and there's occasions and, you know, there's always time for a celebration.
So we're talking about the new vegetarian Cooking for Everyone with Deborah Madison and Pure Vegan by Joseph Schuldiner. And I think it's interesting that both of you talk about some real basics, like having knife skills, like learning to cut things and learning some kitchen skills that might bring somebody from being either intimidated or just unhappy in their own kitchen to being more confident.
Oh, for sure. And I mean, I was actually asked this question when I gave a talk at Google. What is one thing you would tell somebody to make cooking easier? And I said, learn to use a knife, keep it sharp, and have a big cutting board. Because I said, don't use the cutting board that you got for a wedding present for cheese. You know, I mean, it's too small. Give yourself room. Keep your blade sharp. It's not that hard to do. And Joseph, you probably emphasize these kinds of basic skills in your school.
Yes, I've also gotten to know a lot of chefs through my trajectory, and they just said the simple, you know, mechanics of when vegetables or any kind of item is sliced and cut in even units, and any sauce or flavoring added to it, it not only does it each piece cook evenly, the sauce coats everything more readily. So By me upping my knife skills, I think everything tastes so much better just from the mechanics of you know, how big everything is chopped.
Well, yeah, and that's true. But what's interesting to me about that very issue, the sizes of things, is I naturally tend to do everything fine and small. But I've had other people cook my food when they just override my instructions and they maybe chop everything into big, bold pieces. And I see it and I think, why didn't I think of that? You know, it makes such a different impression. It's a completely different dish when you do that. It's like a stew or is it a soup, you know? It makes all the world a difference. But we do have a culinary academy now in Santa Fe, and they regularly give classes in knife skills and basic kitchen skills. And I think this is so valuable to have because then it just opens up all the doors.
Joseph, what do you think are some of the basics that people who are never going to become superb or professional cooks, but just regular people, what do you think are some of the tools and skills that we need?
Well, I mean, we've already covered knife. A sharp knife is, you know, most people don't even have that, so keep that super, super sharp. I think fresh spices. When I go over to friends' houses and cook, I can go through their spice cabinet, and it's either limited or they're really old. And we teach a lot about using whole spices, you know, which keep fresher longer and more pungent flavors. So I always tell people, just, you know, buy spices that are whole when you can get it from a store that has a high turnover, so that they're fresh and they're so much more flavorful. And shop at a farmer's market. You know, your cooking is only going to be as good as the ingredients you put into it. So I'm always stressing that.
One of the things I find myself stressing more and more, especially with the advent of food television on all the time, is it's important for people to understand that cooking takes place in a nonlinear fashion. When you're watching a television show, everything is prepped for them. Everything is measured out. You know, it's kind of a stir and dump routine. That's not how it's going to be in your house. It's quite unlikely that somebody will have made a tray with everything measured out for you. So if you know that, and you know that while your onions are cooking and it's going to take 8 minutes maybe for them to soften, longer for them to caramelize, that's the time you're going to be wanting to get other ingredients together, or even another dish, or use that time to help a kid with their homework, or, you know, it's a very non-linear event, cooking, and the sooner we understand that, I think the less stressful cooking becomes.
I agree, and I also feel like if something goes awry while you're cooking, that it shouldn't stop you from trying that dish again. You know, I'm always learning every time I cook a dish. I always learn something new. So, you know, I think it's important to not judge yourself too strongly either.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah. And besides, the recipe could have a mistake in it. I mean, it does happen, you know, things don't get edited properly. But you learn from your errors, and sometimes you learn well. You get a better dish. I also want to emphasize to people, your hands are your most important tool, as well as your palate. Use your hands. Don't be afraid. You don't have to put on plastic gloves. This is food. We're eating it. You can when you toss a salad, it's your hands that are telling you that leaves are well coated with the vinaigrette. It's not an instruction, you know, toss it 8 times or something. It's your hands that are giving you that information. And it's also really important to taste as you go. Always be tasting, because everyone's palate is different. It's almost impossible to write a recipe, really, when you think of this pot, this pan, that stove, this heat, what altitude, how old are your beans, how salty is your salt, what is your own threshold for saltiness or sweetness. I mean, this is just a minefield of variations. So it's really up to you. I mean, we're, as recipe writers, I feel, trying to give a guide, but it can never be absolute.
It's interesting to me that you both have a little section on sweeteners, and neither of you includes honey.
Really?
Yeah,
I didn't.
Well, I couldn't. I couldn't, because honey is not vegan.
Oh, well, you have a good excuse.
It's cool, because it's not from... Because bees are little...
It comes from a bee.
Ah.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that makes sense.
Well, I'm really surprised I didn't include honey, because I love honey, actually. I do use it not so much as a sweetener, as an additive at the end. So in terms of talking about the kinds of sweeteners you'd use in a cake, that's another thing that's changed. We have all kinds of sugars, all kinds of sweeteners, and even non-sugars, you know, that are sweet.
What is that example of that?
Stevia.
For example,
it's not a sugar, but it's an extremely sweet plant. We have organic sugars that we didn't used to have, which I feel very strongly about using, because their flavor is more interesting and they do less harm. You know.
Now, Joseph, you are in Los Angeles, and one of the things that you mentioned in your book, Pure Vegan, is the amount of urban farming that's going on there. So not only are we talking about farmers markets, but we're talking about people growing things on their balcony or their roof or their yard.
Yeah, the whole urban farm movement has really taken hold in a lot of different cities. And I started about 2 years ago, I started the Altadena Certified Farmers Market, which was an alternative market. And we had some you know, mid-sized to small commercial farmers, but I started discovering a lot of people growing things in their backyard. Someone who were raising goats, chickens in their backyard, and they had too much product after you know they were so successful. They didn't know they couldn't eat everything, and they were giving it away to their neighbors. And this has spawned this whole movement of people starting to share excess food they're growing in their yards. And so in the farmer's market, I actually sort of corralled them, and I found a loophole in the legal codes for farmer's markets to actually certify these backyard urban farmers that they're legally farmers now, and they come weekly and sell in the market. So they brought this whole idea of, you know, talk about farm to table or the local movement, which is, I think, even usurped organic farming, because none of them are certified organic farmers, though they are definitely following organic practices. But they're encouraging people to not only make their own food, but now to grow it. And so I think this is a huge growing movement. It's not going to feed the city. But I think it's a good place to start talking about where your food comes from.
Joseph Schuldiner is author of the new cookbook, Pure Vegan, 70 Recipes for Beautiful Meals and Clean Living. And he will be cooking at Las Cosas in Santa Fe on Saturday, the 24th of May, from 10 to 1. You can go over there and watch him make recipes from this book. And that same evening at Cafe Pasquale's here in Santa Fe, they will be featuring recipes on their menu from the book. That's the evening meal starting at 5 o'clock. And Deborah Madison is author of many cookbooks. Her new one is The New Vegetarian Cooking for Everyone. The two of them will be together at the Real Butcher Shop in the Solana Center from 5 to 8 on Sunday, the 25th of May, talking about their vegan and vegetarian books in a butcher shop, which I just love.
And we'll be serving food, too.
And serving food. I want to thank you both so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe. It's just been great talking to you.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
Thank you for having us.